Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to explore a special investigative report into the rise of U.S. aggression in Syria. Syria is a sovereign nation. Syria is not a promoter of terrorism, and Syria does not represent either a direct or existential threat, actually, to anyone. The United States, Great Britain, France, none of the NATO countries. It's struggling to survive. In fact, many would say that it's one of the most extraordinary events in human history that with so many different nations aligned against Syria, with sanctions to cripple it economically, with the CIA and the national intelligence agencies of at least seven different countries, from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates among them, plus Israel, the United States, Great Britain, and France, that it's highly likely that it would have fallen earlier had it not been for Russia. In fact, it is only because of Russia, less so because of Iran and Hezbollah, that Syrians are alive today. When you look at the history of Syria, as my guests have, when you've actually been to Syria on multiple occasions, as my guests have, when you've gone into the war zones when there was active conflict, which my guests have, and when you report honestly and are not just a shill or propagandist for the mainstream media, your perspective is completely different. I remember speaking with one of the people you're going to hear today, Eva Bartlett. You'll also be hearing from Vanessa Beasley, and two gentlemen who are on the phone now, Ken Stone, a veteran Canadian anti-war social justice and environmental activist, and he is also the treasurer of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War and serves on the steering committee for the Syrian Solidarity Movement and the Canadian Peace Alliance. And he was a participant in the second international tour for peace in Syria. And Ken covers the Syrian crisis for the Hamilton Spectator News and Global Research. He's the author of Defiant Syria, which recounts his observations and analysis while in Syria. And he is going to be joined by Rick Sterling, a retired aerospace engineer and investigative journalist who writes primarily on international relations and who's been involved in the struggles against imperialism and supporting justice in the Middle East and Latin America and U.S.-Russian relations. He is currently the president of the board of Mount Diablo Peace and Justice Center and co-founder and steering committee member of the Syrian Solidarity Movement. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, and his organization's website is SyriansolidarityMovement.org. So I welcome you two gentlemen, and we'll be hearing from Vanessa and Eva a little later. But Eva was telling me about one of her last trips recently to Syria. She wanted to interview Assad. And what she found remarkable was how easy it was to get to him. He and his wife live in a regular building complex, apartment building. The wife goes every day, not with a large armed retinue, but she is frequently seen alone with her children, taking him to school. He drives alone. There are things that are almost unprecedented when you consider how most heads of state, especially in a war-torn country, especially when there's a bounty on his head, especially when Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama made it an issue to try to demonize him, and the war machine ramped up and made him enemy number one, how we must eliminate Assad at the same time that they were also engaged in eliminating Gaddafi. Well, take an honest look at Libya today. Just an honest look. And I've yet to see anyone from CNN, from The Nation magazine, from Mother Jones, from the left or right, from Democracy Now! That's helped support the pro-war against Assad and against Libya. I have yet to see them go to Libya, go to Benghazi, go to Tripoli, and speak with the inhabitants who were there prior to the UN. Well, it really wasn't UN, it was the United States. It was controlling everything, and France, and the little imp of Sarkozy, and Great Britain, and the the people who were behind this and say, well, they're better off now. They're selling slaves in an open market for $400 each in Libya. They were number one in the world, number one in Africa, 54 nations in Africa. They were number one in longevity, number one in percentage of education. They had a higher education index than the United States or Great Britain or Germany, 84% literacy rate, free health care, free education. Gasoline was 27 cents a gallon, and they had no debt. All the revenues were brought into the central treasury and then shared with each and every citizen. No other country in the world does that. Not Norway, not Sweden, not Switzerland, not Denmark. And everyone was guaranteed a right, a home to live in. If you wanted to farm, they bought the equipment and set you up with seeds and everything. And it's clear from the cables that were unearthed by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks that it was all about Gaddafi being the most respected person within the African Union, taking all the major African countries off the dollar as the reserve currency for all their oil and other expenditures and purchases, and put it into the gold denier. And that's why he was killed. That's actually in the text messages from Podesta and other people involved in Hillary Clinton. Yet no investigation, no criticism, no condemnation of all the men, women, and children who were sacrificed, of all the Africans who were sacrificed. And then they tried to do it with Syria. But Syria resisted. Now they're at it again. It is clear that the United States and Mr. Bolton, the National Security Advisor, want the United States not just to interdict in Syria, but to have a permanent base in Syria, even though it's a sovereign country, but to actually go against the Assad regime. It's hard to imagine, but when you have so many allies who are going to work with you, that's a definite possibility. And that's what we're going to talk about. How could we be so wrong so consistently, especially the liberal community? Shame on them. They're supposed to be more fair-minded, better educated on these issues, more understanding of what a sovereign nation should accept and not accept. After all, it was during the 1960s and 70s and 80s that when the United States was illegally training for regime change in 27 other countries that the left came out in protest, and rightly so. Today, they're actually facilitators of this regime change and the destruction that will come with it. It'll be another Libya, and then nobody will care because the deals will have been done, the oil will have been exchanged, whatever they needed Syria for, their ultimate goal will be reached. Those are my comments. Now we're going to play you a short clip. I'm going to ask our engineer to play the clip. It's only 33 seconds long. John Bolton warns Syria. And listen to what he has to say.
We are obviously concerned about the possibility that Assad may use chemical weapons again. We had hoped that our strikes had created structures of deterrence to convince the Assad regime not to do that. We hope that's right. But just so there's no confusion here, if the Syrian regime uses chemical weapons, we will respond very strongly. And they really ought to think about this a long time before they come to any decision.
Okay. Show me the proof that Syria has used chemical weapons against its own citizens. I'd like to see the proof. I have yet to see it, and a lot of other people have yet to see it. To the contrary, we have seen the United States and Great Britain arming with chemical weapons the terrorists, the Free Syrian Army, which is neither free nor are most of them Syrian. These are terrorists. These are John McCain's friends and allies, and the United States is as well. Let's go over it, and we'll start with you, Ken Stone. Talk to us, if you would, about the conflict in Syria, and it's now simmered down. It would seem to be all behind us. Assad's forces offensive largely captured most of the remaining strongholds of ISIS. there were reports of Syrian rebels being given refuge in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights as well. And then last month, John Bolton put forth claims U.S. intelligence had evidence that Assad would gas his people again, although there is no evidence to support that he did it the first time and that he was being accused of this so that they could cross that magic, you know, red line and go about getting his country into other people's hands, mainly Saudi Arabia and Turkey. So talk about this whole idea and challenge the John Boltons and virtually everyone on the left and right. From Amy Goodman, challenge her. It's time someone challenged. The left's not going to challenge her. And challenge the people at Fox, the warmongers over there. Challenge the people on MSNBC, because none of them have got it right a single time about Syria. The forum is yours.
Thanks, Gary. And I'm really pleased to be on your show. The left in the United States and in Canada and the Western world in general has really failed in its duty to defend Syria and its people against an illegal and unjustifiable war for regime change in Damascus. And that's because they have given up, or they have completely ignored the question of national sovereignty and territorial integrity. The left has fallen for what we call the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, and that is that Western powers or great powers can intervene in the domestic affairs of other countries if they feel that the human rights of the people of those countries are not being protected by the government. And in fact, it was the Canadian government under Paul Martin in 2005 that sold this to the United Nations. And it, what it was an attempt to override what is the basic tenet of international law, which is recognition of international solidarity and non-interference in the domestic affairs of other countries. And the first time, the very first time that this doctrine was applied at the United Nations was in Libya. And you have described the utterly terrifying consequences of the intervention, the humanitarian intervention, so-called humanitarian intervention in Libya, which destroyed the country, killed the leader, Muammar Gaddafi, and has left the country as a failed state. And since then, the United States has led a coalition of countries to do the same thing in Syria. You mentioned that as well. And they have had the help of all the usual suspects in NATO, including, unfortunately, the governments of Canada, two different ones, a conservative one and a liberal one. And they have had the help of their henchmen in the Gulf, the UAE, Kuwait, Qatar, and of course Saudi Arabia, and also Israel. So all of these countries, a giant cabal of countries, had a meeting in 2012 in Tunisia, and the meeting was organized with the help of the Canadian ambassador. And at that meeting, they formed something called the Friends of Syria Group of countries, and they decided to divvy up the tasks to overthrow the government of Syria. And what happened was they were expecting Syria to fall in a matter of months, but as you point out, Syria had strong allies in Russia, Iran, China, and in Hezbollah from Lebanon, and they have managed to resist. And they have managed now, in 2018, to have driven out the terrorists from all parts of Syria, or practically all the parts of Syria, except the northwestern corner of Idlib. But I also have to point out to you that, as you mentioned briefly, the U.S. has occupied formally the northeastern third of Syria, where the oil industry is located, the main source of water, the Euphrates River, and the best agricultural land. So the U.S. is sitting on one-third of Syria, and just yesterday I was reading reports from the State Department that there is no intention on the part of the United States to leave. So how does the U.S. justify this? Well, it justifies it basically on two things. One was the question of humanitarian intervention. They said that they were there to protect Syrian civilians, and now in the northeastern corner of Syria, they're there to protect the rights of Kurdish people in Syria. And also the other thing that the United States uses is something Barack Obama was a favorite of Barack Obama's, which was the idea of American exceptionalism, that the United States was a special and indispensable country, and it was exceptional, and it didn't have to pay attention to international law. So if you want to say where's the failing of the left in the Western world, I would say it's that they go along with this feeling of exceptionalism. They go along with the idea of humanitarian intervention in other countries, which is, in our opinion, in the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, just another form of the white man's burden that the Brits used to build their empire. And when it came to defending the Syrian government, they were nowhere around. They were MIA. And so there's only been in the West a handful of groups and people with the courage to stand up and defend the people and the government of Syria against this illegal Western intervention. That's my view.
That's Ken Stone. Now let's say hello to our other guest, who is Richard Sterling. Richard, let's pick it up from there. Give us your detailed understanding of the previous challenges against Assad, that he was using sarin gas, especially in light of what we have found from Seymour Hersh's investigation and other investigations, including the one that was conducted in Geneva, that did not find that he had used the gases, including on the ground Vanessa Beelthiel, who was there in the hospital. And we're going to hear from her in a few minutes about how much lies and virtually everything that the New York Times has said. They can't tell the truth on any of it. They're just pathologically lying. So I'd like to hear your perspective on it. Please go ahead.
Right. Well, first of all, it's nice to be here, Gary, and it's good to be here as well with Ken, my friend Ken Stone. Well, going back to August of 2013, which is when the first major incident happened in eastern Ghouta, which is a district on the outskirts of Damascus, it was a huge media sensation when overnight the social media was flooded with images of children dying and children lined up on the floors. And it was immediately claimed that the Assad government was responsible for the atrocity. And that, of course, at the time, the pressure within the United States and the forces that wanted to attack Syria were telling Barack Obama, they've crossed the red line, which you yourself laid down. You have to attack Syria directly. In other words, the U.S. needed to go from just supporting the proxy armies, the proxy so-called rebels, to a direct attack. Obama resisted that, and they ended up with Russia. They ended up coming with an agreement whereby Syria agreed to give up all of its chemical weapons, which it did have as a counter to Israeli nuclear weapons. And over the coming 12 months, they gave up all of their chemical weapons. That was supervised by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which received a Nobel Prize as a result of it. And it was quite a remarkable accomplishment, actually. The chemical weapons were actually neutralized on board a U.S. vessel in the Mediterranean. So, in other words, the U.S. had their hands on the chemical weapons. Whatever sarin was in the Syrian stockpile, the U.S. Was able to get samples of that. And that, of course, raises suspicions about any example where the U.S. claims that they have an identity match with sarin today. But since then, there have been numerous cases where it was alleged that the Syrian government used chlorine and used other chemical weapons. The serious investigations into it were never, they were either never conclusive or they actually pointed to the armed opposition groups being responsible. Going back to that big case in 2013, the UN report finally concluded that the missiles could only have traveled about 5 kilometers, which put the launching site squarely in the middle of rebel-controlled territory. So it was not even in territory that was controlled by the government in Syria. And Seymour Hersh did two major reports, which pointed to the Turkish government having supplied the sarin to the Al Qaeda terrorists in Syria. That was further confirmed later on by two Turkish parliamentary deputies in the Turkish parliament who produced the documents. And then the other stories ever since then, whenever there's been a chemical weapons incident, there's been immediate accusations from the so-called rebels, as well as those who want the U.S. and NATO to get involved Assad has done it again. We need to attack Syria, or we need to bomb Syria, or we need to escalate the war. They've crossed the red line once again. And we see this very much going on today. Now, in April of 2017 and April of 2018, there were chemical weapons incidents or allegations of chemical weapons incidents, and Trump actually did attack. They fired dozens and over 100 missiles the last time around, which the first one killed about a dozen people, including several children. The last time around, I didn't see a casualty count, but they did the attack. And the danger now, I mean, going back to the Bolton clip that you played, he's basically saying it's going to be dramatically more intense. So they are setting the stage. It's pretty evident they're setting the stage for another incident that they will immediately accuse the Syrian government of being responsible for, and then the U.S. will attack directly. Now, what's going to happen then? What's going to happen if the U.S. missiles kill Russian soldiers or Iranian advisors? Russia has said that they, if their forces are attacked, they will respond. The U.S. has bases all over the Middle East, including in eastern Syria, and it would not be a hard thing for the Russians to attack them. This is how dangerous the situation is. Another worrisome development, in addition to John Bolton coming into the White House. More recently, we've had James Jeffrey, who's another neoconservative, very much aligned with Israeli interests and neoconservative interests. He is the new Mideast advisor to Secretary of State Pompeo. This is really worrisome. Just today in the Wall Street Journal, we had an op-ed that is purportedly written by Turkish President Erdogan. Now, we don't know whether Erdogan actually wrote the editorial or not, but the points in the editorial are basically the usual litany that the world needs to attack Syria. They need to prevent Syria from removing terrorists. It's titled, "The World Must Stop Assad." But if you think about it logically, what are they going to stop Assad from doing? Assad is out to remove Al Qaeda and other terrorists from its territory. What would they do in Canada if Al Qaeda terrorists and other terrorists controlled half of British Columbia? What would they do in the United States if terrorists controlled Oregon State? But the sad reality is that the U.S. has been using the terrorists as part of its campaign to overthrow Syria, and they don't want to see that project fail. So they are prolonging the conflict, and the most hawkish and right-wing forces, it looks like they're prepared to risk international war. to prolong the conflict and to prevent the Syrian government and its allies from prevailing against the onslaught of at points it was up over 100,000 terrorists, heavily armed, fully supported, trained, flooding into the country especially through the Turkish border, but also through the Lebanese border and also through Jordan.
Okay, I appreciate those insights. Thank you, Richard. Richard Sterling. Now, if you've just joined us, I'm Gary Knoll, and we're talking about a special investigation with four different investigative reporters who are not the suck-ups and the lapdogs of CNN's reporters, all of them, or they're all in the establishment pocket on this issue. They may change positions on other issues, but it's all pro-war all the time. It doesn't matter what their affiliation, and we don't have, except for the real alternative media, like Truth Dig, Consortium News, and Progressive Radio Network and others, Black Agenda Report, we are standing up telling the truth. They are not. And over the weekend, the Russians accused the United States of dropping white phosphorus bombs on the Syrian settlement of Hajin. And white phosphorus, by the way, is banned by international law. The Pentagon has denied it, claiming U.S. troops don't possess it. That's a lie. Everything the Pentagon says is a lie. The U.S. did use white phosphorus against Fallujah in 2004 and 2005. The government was forced to admit it after the Washington Post and the BBC reported on its use. So who does the average person believe? Or is this a black flag operation conducted by the United States and Israel? It seems to be a game of tic-tac between the U.S. and Russia. And Rick, again to you, since you investigate U.S.-Russian relations and the new Cold War is largely focused on Syria, how do you interpret these events?
Well, I think at the deeper level, there are two key conflict points in the relations between Russia and the U.S. One is the Ukraine, where a coup, a U.S. Promoted and funded coup took place in February of 2014, and rather than just rolling over. The people in eastern Ukraine, who are primarily Russian ethnicity, they resisted the illegal overthrow of the Kiev government, and they have sought some kind of independent relationship since one of the first acts of the coup government was to remove Russian as one of the official state languages. And then in the Crimea, which is very important and where Russia traditionally has its Black Sea fleet, Crimea was kind of an exceptional case. There's been so much misinformation about that. I did visit it in 2016. I visited Crimea. It's quite an amazing country where they say there's 2 million people and 100 different ethnicities, but they basically have a 200-year history as being part of Russia. And it was within the Soviet Union that the Crimea Republic was transferred under the administration of Ukraine, but they were all part of the Soviet Union. So it was just a pro forma change in a sense. But when the Soviet Union broke up and the Ukraine seceded from the Soviet Union, then it became more of an issue. But it didn't come to a head until the coup that took place in Kiev in February of 2014. Then the people in Crimea quickly organized an election. The turnout was something like 85%, and 95% of the people who voted to rejoin with Russia. That was all pretty well documented, and it was even acknowledged in the New York Times that the overwhelming sentiment within Crimea was to be part of Russia, not Ukraine. But so the two big conflict points are one, the Ukraine, and of course NATO is pushing up against the Russian border, and Ukraine is the real, that is the kind of the soft belly of Russia, so to speak. So it's extremely critical. The other critical issue is Syria. Russia only has two foreign foreign bases outside the former Soviet Union. One's in Vietnam, and the other is in Syria. So they've got a long alliance. Russia has a long alliance with Syria, and the idea of the Syrian government being overthrown, resulting in the chaos, the explosion of extremism, as has happened in Libya, they were not prepared to see that happen, and so Syria, with its alliance with Iran, with its support from the progressive forces within Lebanon, and also support from progressive forces within Iraq, they've joined together and stood up. One thing that's important for listeners to be clear about is that the Syrian government it's a multi-ethnic society. It's a semi-socialist society with free education, free health care, large industry is state-controlled. There's lots of private small businesses, but large industry is state-controlled. They have respect for all religions, in sharp contrast with the extremist ideologies and the fanatical religious beliefs of much of the opposition promoted by Qatar and Saudi Arabia and so forth. So it's quite a, and first and foremost, they've held a progressive position internationally. They've refused to just knuckle under to the World Bank, to the International Monetary Fund, to the United States. Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, went there in 2010 and issued three virtual demands to the Syrian leadership, calling for them to stop their friendship with Iran, to stop supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, and to come to an agreement with Israel. And Syria politely but firmly said, well, thank you for your advice or your suggestions, but no, we're an independent country, and we'll make the friends that we need to make for our own interests.
Richard, you forgot one issue, and that is Syria and Assad has given the women of Syria absolute mm-hmm. authority over their lives.
Exactly.
Syrian women can dress as they want. It is against the law to insult a Syrian woman. More Syrian
yes.
women hold positions in education than men do. More Syrian women graduate from college with advanced degrees than do the men. There's a substantial women representation within their governing body. And
right.
They're very progressive, and they do not discriminate. So none of the reasons that you would be against Saudi Arabia, who is just completely misogynist and bigoted mm-hmm. and racist, mm-hmm. you don't have any of that in Syria, just like you didn't have it in Libya. Isn't it interesting that the liberal community in the United States shows how bankrupt it is and why people are leaving it in the gazillions, because nobody wants to be a part of such an intellectually and spiritually dishonest group where you support the neocons when there should be support of the Syrian people. And this whole nonsense that Obama and Clinton promoted about humanitarian intervention, that's like a humanitarian death. There is no such thing as humanitarian death. You know, there's no such thing. It doesn't exist. It's an oxymoron. In any case, what we're going to do now, we're going to go to a clip. And I'm going to play now a clip about the white helmets, because you talk about getting it wrong. The Academy got it wrong. All the actors and actresses in California got it wrong who voted on this. The Amy Goodman, Democracy Now! Got it dead wrong, promoting him on her show. And we called it, we said that they were terrorists, and just common sense. All of the films you've ever seen about ISIS and al-Nusra, show them when they capture a person, whether it's a doctor, a kid, a woman, a journalist, they kill them, they behead them. And they generally do this publicly to show that they're in contempt of these. And yet we're supposed to believe that these Syrian physicians or these medics, these aid people, were able to be in only the terrorist territory. They were completely invisible anywhere else. And then in came the video. I received the video, and I put it on my website, showing them executing people, including Syrian soldiers, and it was the white helmets doing the execution and loading the bodies on the truck and sending on their bodies, you know, like they were a trophy kill. And so we broadcast. We were the first to have both of the guests that we're going to hear from right in a moment, Vanessa Beasley and Eva Bartlett, on to talk about this because they were in the battlefield. So we're going to listen to a segment now, and the person you're going to hear now, Vanessa Beasley, visited the hospitals, interviewed the doctors. She was the one who said there was no chemical attack. They were there. She was there. She interviewed the people right afterwards, and everything was staged. They brought in, a truck came in with actors, and they started coughing, and it was bombs blowing up nearby and people coming in because they'd taken refuge in tunnels, and they were choking on the dust. They came in there, they gave them water, they hydrated them. They were fine. There were no casualties. But that's not what we saw on television. Now, oh, by the way, television also showed the same young girl in four different supposed cities as a victim, and she's wearing the same clothes. So much propaganda, so much setup. So she just completely eviscerates. She deserved the Pulitzer Prize, both of them do, for what they did, because there's no American journalist that had the courage to do this. Let's now go to the clip.
Follow your work, I follow Vanessa's, and I follow Patrick's. And one of the things that I see, this paradigm, this new hybrid type of warfare, which that's what the white helmets are. And what I find really disturbing and extremely dangerous is that this new hybrid, this paradigm, is replacing what media, what journalism should be all about. Because as we just heard from Patrick, everybody just takes it all in. You know, oh, here's the picture. Okay. Here's the recording. Okay. And then you just circulate it here. It's taking journalism out of the picture completely. And I would also say that we have these editors, particularly on the major networks around the world, that they just kowtow to official lines. I mean, this is a dramatic change. We saw this starting in 2003 with the Iraq War, and they've just gotten better and better and better at it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In my last visit to Syria, I went twice to Aleppo with mainly the express intent of seeing what life was like in Aleppo, but also to speak with the Aleppo Medical Association. And this is an important factor because this association has over 4,160 registered doctors. And so, you know, when we talk about these talking points that are taken as fact by most corporate media and unfortunately some alternative media that are supposed to be representing the left, they will run these headlines. We've seen it especially quite recently, the last doctor in Aleppo, the last pediatrician in Aleppo, the last hospitals in Aleppo. And so, you know, establishing that there are actually over 4,000 registered doctors in Aleppo, including 800 specialists, is one important aspect. But also visiting, as a journalist would, to visit the hospitals that have been attacked, actually attacked and documented by these Western-backed terrorists. For example, the Dabit Maternity Hospital in Aleppo, which was attacked on May 3rd. This is important, and this is something that these corporate media journalists could do if they were interested in telling the truth. They could have gone to Jeble, which on May 23rd, at the same day that Tartus was attacked, Jeble suffered a series of massive terrorist suicide and car bombing attacks. And this is, you would think that this was important news. One of these attacks was a suicide bomber that exploded himself in the emergency ward of the Jeble hospital, which was already treating people that had been injured in prior suicide attacks that day. So these are very key stories that didn't get any coverage in the corporate media. Meanwhile, you have outlets like Fox showing the Kindy hospital Hospital, which was a state hospital, the best in the Middle East for cancer treatment, that was destroyed. It was truck bombed in December 2013 by al-Nusra. And now you have Fox showing this hospital, this image, and saying that this is in eastern Aleppo and that the so-called government airplanes have destroyed it. This is the level of propaganda that we're dealing with. And one day to the next, you'll see the last hospital, the last four hospital, the last doctors, the last 20 doctors. There's no consistency even in their lies.
You know, Vanessa, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this program, you know, number one is that the White Helmets are given such a pass without a real investigation. I know that you, all three of you, have done work on the White Helmets here. What I worry about most is that this is going to be used as the reason. Something must be done. I mean, oh, no, you know, Nobel Prize possibly here. I mean, they've been elevated so much. They've been groomed so much here. And because they don't have any logical reason, because of international law, that this is going to be one of the last straws. You know, this is what we have to be supporting here. And Western publics are just pumped and pumped day in, day out with this kind of stuff here. And I truly worry that it's going to be used as a reason to start, escalate this conflict even more to a disastrous level, if that's even possible for that poor country, Syria. Go ahead, Vanessa.
Yeah, you know, that you're so right there, and it's really worrying. I mean, I think if it is announced that they win the Nobel Peace Prize tomorrow, then we're being driven to the precipice of war and moral bankruptcy, because this organization is not only embedded in Nusra, al-Qaeda territory, ISIS territory, all the various factions, whether it's Nour al-Din Zinki. Last night, Channel 4 put out a video where they actually followed Nour al-Din Zinki. Now, Nour al-Din Zinki, as we know, beheaded a 12-year-old Palestinian child, Abdullah Issa, a few weeks ago. And here is Channel 4, basically very like CNN, normalizing suicide bombers, talking about suicide bombers as if it's a perfectly acceptable form of attack against civilians in West Aleppo. And also running alongside the Nour al-Din Zinki were the White Helmets, actually during the attacks. And it's on film with Channel 4. It's not picked up. You know, I would really like to challenge these media organizations, these BBCs and Channel 4. Only a few days ago in Holland, there was an al-Qaeda operative that gave an interview to Dutch TV who was later found to be registered on the UK government al-Qaeda list. You know, are we reaching a point where our entire news stream out of Syria is going to be brought to us by al-Qaeda or by those who are linked to al-Qaeda? The White Helmets are not only linked to al-Qaeda in the sense that they are embedded in those areas. There are numerous videos out there of them participating in the capture of civilians, in the beating, in the torture of civilians. Their operatives have been known to post to their social media sites videos of the torture and the public execution of prisoners of war, Syrian Arab Army soldiers. We were told that that one particular operative was sacked, but no official statement was made by this humanitarian NGO to condemn a public execution and torture of prisoners of war, which contravenes every single Geneva Convention that exists on the rules of war. And there was a further execution of a civilian in Aleppo, which was filmed, where basically the White Helmets came in as a mop-up operation.
Yeah,
you know, and then add to that the testimony from the real Syria Civil Defense. We're not just seeing an outreach organization for the States and the UK. We're seeing an organization that's embedded in terrorist areas and is supporting and facilitating terrorist activity.
You know, Patrick, it seems to me that the White Helmets are actually just a PR proxy for a failed policy in Syria by the West, particularly the United States. It's diversion. It's shifting the topic. We prefer to talk about this. And like I said, I want to stress here, I'm not saying because I don't know. Maybe they do save some people. I'm going to be very careful with my words, as a journalist should be. But at the same time, they are being used as a proxy to prepare Western audiences for the next step. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think you have. There has to be a level of skepticism in journalism and the media, because clearly you're not going to get it from government. That's for certain. Our government has proven time and time again that is willing to go to any depth. It's willing to lie, cheat, to deceive the public. This is proven fact. This is history. Okay, and they've proven that. So where's the fourth estate? Where's the media? There has to be a level of skepticism in looking at these images and saying, what exactly are we looking here? And, you know, having worked in first aid, having, you know, being certified International Red Cross person in the past for work, I've done first aid. I've had to use backboards for spinal injuries. You never see any of this in any of their videos. It's just man holding child over the shoulder and then the dramatic well-lit picture. And some of these videos, you can look at them, and any normal person who's in video editing will see it's heavily edited for the money shot, and also that it's unauthentic completely. You could say that it's fake or staged in many cases. We posted these online for people to look at, and most people are saying, agreeing, yes, some of these are staged. So even if a few of them are fake, and these are being used to influence public perception, to get the public behind regime change or behind an escalation of war by the United States and its coalition, then this is a big problem. Then there's a level of deception going on here. And then to parlay that into a Nobel Peace Prize is just on another level. I think if they do win the Nobel Peace Prize, it'll be the end of the Nobel Peace Prize, because there's so much evidence out there. There's so much visual forensic evidence that point to this being a...
Now, so there we had Vanessa Beely and Eva Bartlett. I'm not sure who the gentleman was. And they've been on this program many times in the past, and they've documented how the White Helmets are little more than a propaganda mechanism for all parties involved in the regime change to get rid of Assad. They're not legitimate. And, of course, along with this is John McCain over there beating the drums any place he can and actually meeting with terrorists. We actually posted the photograph on my website of John McCain meeting with known identified terrorists. And yet the media did not challenge him on this. And there is so much evidence the White Helmets were connected with jihadists, fundamentalist groups, ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, the Syrian Free Army, and it's fully infiltrated by the groups. So that's where we stand now with the White Helmets. We've challenged them in at least six different shows. Back to you, Ken. So Ken Stone, who's up in Hamilton, Ontario, Ken, would you speak about the Trump White House's relationship with Turkey's President Erdogan, who is a loose cannon, a pariah now with respect to NATO, an absolute, they've brought it to a theocracy for all intents and purposes with respect to their relationship and also his relationship with NATO. And who are the Syrian Democratic Forces, which my research seems to indicate is a mercenary force comprised not only of Syrians, but Arabs, Syrians and Armenians and Turks and Kurdish groups? And are they still operative on the ground in Syria? In fact, which anti-Assad groups, besides the United States, are the most represented in Syria now?
Well, that's a broad question. Let's start with the SDF. Those are the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces that are, it's basically an army of irregulars that the U.S. has created. I've seen figures of up to 46 or 48,000 that they're aiming for in the northeast part of Syria to act as their foot soldiers in that area in order to hold it and not let the Syrian government get it back. It's part of Syrian territory, and the United States is sitting on it with about a dozen military bases. As Rick pointed out, the reason they're doing so is in order to prolong the conflict in Syria and also to make it a war of attrition and to bleed the Syrian government, not to allow the Syrian government to recover its main source of revenue, which is the oil fields east of the Euphrates. So this is part of U.S. strategy. They are claiming that they are protecting Kurds in that part of Syria. Well, the Kurds in that part of Syria The Kurds are spread out in a number of countries in the Middle East, including Syria. And the U.S. and Israel has been using the Kurds as their own proxies to destabilize those countries, such as Syria, Iraq, Iran. If you want to go to the bigger picture, which I didn't really get to in my first part, the first time I talked, I think you have to say, now, what is the big picture? What is the game plan of the United States in Syria? And I think it's part of a plan to dominate the Middle East and to dominate the entire world. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the 90s, the United States was, in fact, the only superpower. And they used that influence to spread their to spread their influence around the world. But since 2015, when the Russians intervened successfully in Syria, the United States has been faced with a multipolar world. The Russians and the Chinese are great powers that are reasserting themselves again. But nonetheless, the United States right now, its purpose hasn't changed at all. It's world domination. And people like Amy Goodman and all the other people who defend U.S. foreign policy in Libya, in Syria, against Iran, et cetera, are all basically defending the empire. They are, whether they know it or not, they are defending the U.S. strategic aim of world hegemony. And we have to keep that in mind. And that's why those people are so disappointing to us, because they call themselves leftists, and they're not. In as much as Turkey is involved, Turkey is a NATO country, but Turkey has, in the last few years, become estranged from the U.S. To some extent because of the attempted coup that took place a couple of years ago, which the Turkish government under Erdogan blamed on the U.S. In the period since then, Turkey has participated in a parallel peace process for Syria called some people call it the Astana process, where Russia, Turkey, and Iran meet separately from the Geneva peace process on Syria. And they have, you know, taken some pretty significant steps about isolating the terrorists in zones in Syria. And it's been useful because it's helped to bring about the end of the war. I don't know how things are going to shake out between Turkey and the U.S. in the end. I don't know that anybody knows how that's going to work out, because both governments are led by people who are very mercurial. And we don't know how it's going to shake out. But what I would say about Turkey is that it's no longer in the back pocket of the U.S. the way it used to be as a NATO country. It's showing some independence, and it's showing some friendship, or at least cooperation with Russia and with Iran. So we are in a situation of flux, and as Rick already pointed out, we don't know. Really, nobody in the world knows. It's very much like 1914 instead of 2018. We don't know what could happen in the next few days or few weeks when and if the White Helmets are used to stage another chemical weapons attack, and United States and other Western powers such as Britain and France decide to use the allegedly 70 platforms for launching cruise missiles into Syria, whose combined total is 380 cruise missiles. Anything could go wrong, and it could lead to a major widening of the war, to a regional war. It could lead to a major confrontation between the superpowers, which could have disastrous consequences for the entire world, because the superpowers are all nuclear armed. So the relationship between Turkey and the United States and between the United States and Russia and China and all the other powers, all the other client states all around Syria who participated in the regime change operation so far, what it amounts to is the same kind of powder keg that existed in 1914 in the Balkans. All it needs is a single spark, and the whole thing could go off with terrible consequences for everybody, not just the people in the Middle East. It could affect people right here in North America.
Well, Ken Stone and Rick Sterling, I want to thank you both for coming on and sharing your points of view. And we also heard earlier from Vanessa Beasley and Eva Bartlett. My final quick thought is this. War is good for Wall Street and the armaments industry, for the 200,000 private individual and corporate contractors who need war. They are the ones who support the think tanks that bring forth the John Boltons, the permanent group of people in Washington that promote war. Whether you're Democrat or Republican, it doesn't matter. The people in the White House are not the ultimate power. It's the people behind them who have their own agenda, whether it's oil in a country. But what they forget are people like Muqtada Sadr in Iraq. He left the scene. When he left the scene and his army went to ground and put down their weapons, that's, for all intents and purposes, that was the beginning of the end of America's involvement in Iraq. He went into Qom, the religious capital of Iran, and he studied there to become a full mullah, as his father was. Now, he's back in Iran. He's back in Iraq. He's extremely powerful. Without question, he's the most powerful cleric in that part of the Middle East. And he supports Assad and the Shia, not the Sunni. So you got to look at all the different cast of characters. So what is the likelihood that if there was a full-out go for it in Syria, Russia's not going to back down, doesn't need to. The United States could never beat Russia. Look, we couldn't beat a group of individuals running around on mules and camels and foot, and they're stronger than ever after 17 years in Afghanistan. They have more country under control now than they did at the beginning. We just wasted, you know, $1.6 trillion minimally. That does not include future cost to take care of these people. So that's where we're at this moment. And I believe that we are very foolish, and we're misguided, and we're uneducated. We're listening to the people on the news as if they're actually objective and fair-minded and not biased. They're extremely biased, and they have their own agendas. And good for those who are willing to stand up and tell the truth. But you go into Syria any further, if you think Syria now is going to be like Libya, you're making some gross mistakes, because when you add up all that Iran has, Russia has, Lebanon has, Syria has, then what could be coming from Iraq, it is an endless war. There'll be millions of dead people, and the war industry will just be lapping it up. And that's unfortunate that we have this hegemony principle that you talked about in Imperial Overdrive with Manifest Destiny. Thank you all for sharing your insights. I appreciate it. I'm Gary Nall. This brings us to the end of our program. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.